Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 15th of July, these are our main stories. After sanctions from Washington over Hong Kong and Britain's rejection of Huawei, Beijing has fought back. We'll hear the details. We investigate allegations that the healthcare system in one South African province has collapsed in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. And
coronavirus is something we should take very seriously.
How the people of Japan have been doing just that by wearing face masks and keeping their country's infection rate low. Also in this podcast, why the European Commission failed in its bid to take a $13 billion bite out of Apple's profits. And
these veterans and their families put their trust in this nursing assistant, and she betrayed that trust and decided to pick and choose who lived and who died.
A former nursing assistant in the US is facing jail for killing seven elderly patients. Beijing has been defending itself on two fronts today. Firstly, it dismissed US sanctions imposed over its new security law in Hong Kong as malicious slander. Then, just hours after the UK scrapped plans to use the Chinese-owned telecoms firm Huawei to help build its 5G networks, Beijing's ambassador to London made a plea for good relations with Europe. Liu Xiaoming said Europe and China shared a commitment to multilateralism and international law, and he urged European countries to stay out of China's internal affairs, saying it would stay out of theirs.
Those who see China as a systematic rival or a potentially hostile state have got it all wrong. They've chosen the wrong target, and they are heading in the wrong direction. What China cares most is to improve the well-being of the Chinese people. China's priority is to realize national rejuvenation. And for this purpose, China aspires a peaceful and stable world.
Well, Stephen McDonnell is our correspondent in Beijing, where the foreign ministry has been holding a news conference. I asked Stephen first what had been said about the new American sanctions.
Again, the Chinese government has told the Trump administration to butt out of Hong Kong. They're saying that these new sanctions against individuals, police, certain government officials who are said to have been undermining freedom in that city, they're saying these moves by the US are illegal, and that this is one of the reasons why we set up this national security law to try and stop this kind of international interference from other countries in Hong Kong. Now, again, Beijing has said that there'll be some sort of unspecified countermeasures. This is the same that's happened with all the other sanctions over the last few weeks.
And, Stephen, there was a particularly robust reaction to this decision by the British government to strip the Chinese telecoms company Huawei from its 5G network over security concerns. What have they been saying?
Basically, the Chinese government is saying that UK-China relations have virtually collapsed as a result of this decision. They've said that it has severely undermined mutual trust. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said that there'd be some sort of measures, some sort of response to, in her words, protect the legitimate interests of Chinese companies. Now, naturally, we're asking, what measures are you going to take? And she rather cryptically said, well, that if you grow a melon, you reap a melon, and that deeds reap results. But that first, the Chinese government would have to seriously evaluate this decision to remove Huawei components from the UK's 5G network before it acted.
And Beijing really didn't take kindly to the fact that Donald Trump was effectively taking credit for the UK's decision, did it?
No, well, not only that, they're saying that it proves that this has got nothing to do with national security and everything to do with political manipulation. They said that basically the UK is just going along with what the US wants them to do. You know, at one point, they even sort of cryptically, again, sort of asked the question, is the UK, you know, some sort of cat's paw for the US? And also, in a funny way, rubbing it in a little bit by saying that, okay, this is a bad decision in our view, but really this is a big world. The UK is only a small part of it. So ultimately, this decision isn't going to harm Huawei from prospering globally anyway. It's just that it's a bit of an inconvenience. So I suppose on the one hand, they're saying it's a big deal, but on the other, hand, they're sort of trying to belittle the government of Boris Johnson by saying, oh, Huawei will get by either way.
Stephen McDonald, our correspondent in the Chinese capital there. So as Stephen was saying, China's foreign ministry wanted to emphasise that Chinese companies will prosper despite any attempts by the US and its allies to target them. Karishma Vaswani, our Asia business correspondent, assesses the impact these diplomatic and commercial rows could have on other international companies trading with China.
I think this is really going to be the way that the world does business going forward. Companies are going to have to choose, and you're already seeing those sorts of decisions being made. You know, increasingly, corporations are going to be forced to take sides. That's expensive. And it's not just companies. It will be governments as well. We've already seen the decision by the UK government on Huawei out here in Singapore just a few weeks ago. The Singapore government also made a decision about its 5G networks, and it decided to go with Ericsson and Nokia. Huawei still plays a part, but it's not the major player. One of the reasons behind that, I've been told, is because Singapore is a huge base for American companies, and the worry was that with this pressure from Washington, and if Singapore had had Huawei in its 5G networks to the extent that it originally had planned to do, then it couldn't provide those services to these companies. So these sorts of commercial decisions are becoming political in a world that is becoming increasingly split down the middle between the United States and China, and we're caught in the middle of it all.
Karishma Vaswani, our Asia business correspondent. A BBC investigation has revealed chronic failures in the health system of South Africa's Eastern Cape province, where key staff are on strike or sick with COVID-19. Nurses are being forced to act as cleaners, and there are reports of unnecessary deaths in overcrowded, understaffed wards. Exhausted doctors and nurses say the province's health system has collapsed under the strain of the coronavirus pandemic, with one medic calling it an epic failure of a deeply corrupt system. Our correspondent Andrew Harding has more on the distressing conditions at Livingstone Hospital in Port Elizabeth, the main COVID hospital in the Eastern Cape.
We've been investigating two state hospitals in Port Elizabeth where we discovered a health system in total meltdown. We saw filthy wards, we saw images of rats drinking blood from hospital drains and of mothers being left waiting so long for urgent surgery that several babies died stillborn. Many key staff, from cleaners to nurses, are too afraid of catching the virus to even show up for work, leaving just a handful of exhausted staff to cope. One of them is Dr. John Black, who told me the immediate crisis in Port Elizabeth is the result of years of mismanagement and neglect.
We certainly were understaffed to start with. And you add the COVID-related illness, you're down about 30% of staff at any given day. We've had large mental health-related issues with people burning out, and it's created a lot of conflict. So rather as working as teams, everyone has started turning on each other in many respects. And at the other end of it are the patients who are queuing up and there are reports of patients fighting for oxygen, limited bed capacity, limited staff. So what ends up is the group of willing people who are living from hand to mouth, just having to go the extra mile to do things that they wouldn't normally do. So whether that's the surgeons and the nurses cleaning the theatres or the doctors portering or people taking laundry to go and get washed.
So it's a tiny, heroic band of people who are keeping this hospital going.
People feel a moral responsibility, but at the same time there's a huge amount of fear. We have a large number of people who are unhealthy, hypertensive, diabetic, HIV-positive nursing population or porter population or doctor population, and you know the risk is huge. And when you've got shortages of PPE, you're not quite sure where it's going to come from. To ask people to make those sacrifices is quite a big thing.
Can you talk about the politics, about the lack of leadership behind this crisis?
Well, I can certainly say from a local point of view, we've been rudderless for some time now. We haven't had a permanent employed CEO or top management for about 18 months. So when you're starting with a system that has poor management as well as poor resources and tired staff, the ability to rebound and respond to that call is very limited. So I'm hoping for the best, despite knowing that, you know, around every corner you're going to face a crisis that you might not be able to deal with.
Dr. John Black from Port Elizabeth speaking to Andrew Harding. In many countries, public opinion is divided over mask wearing. Here in England, after months of debate, from next week, everyone will be required to wear a face mask when entering shops. And in the United States, some supporters of President Trump say forcing people to wear masks is an infringement of their civil liberties. But in Japan, mask wearing is almost universal, and many believe it's been key to their low death rate from COVID-19. From Tokyo, Rupert Wingfield-Hayes reports.
I'm standing at the exit to Shinagawa Station in Tokyo. This is the biggest commuter station in this vast metropolis. And right now, in the middle of rush hour, tens of thousands of people are pouring off commuter trains and heading for nearby offices. I'm counting to see if I can find anybody who is not wearing a face mask. And the answer is, I have not seen a single person who is not wearing a face mask.
I don't think it's acceptable not to wear a mask. I think everyone in the world should do so. Coronavirus is something we should take very seriously.
The utility of mask wearing for protecting you from COVID-19 is still hotly debated around the world. But the difference in death rate, mortality rate from COVID-19 between countries like Japan, where mask wearing is universal, and countries where they are not, is very striking. Currently, the United States has a mortality rate of around 400 per million. In Britain, it is over 600 per million. Here in Japan, which has not had a lockdown, the death rate is just 7 per million.
Stand down, stand down, stand down, stand down, stand down.
On their television screens and social media feeds, people across East Asia have been watching the anti-mask protests in the United States with a mixture of shock and bemusement. Professor Keiji Fukuda is himself an American and one of the world's leading experts on public health. From his office at Hong Kong University, he's watched the mask battles back home with growing despair.
There is almost a willful, flagrant desire to show that I'm not going to do what other people are telling me to do. So I'm not going to wear a mask. And it's been transformed from the idea, how do we protect each other, to I'm going to show that I'm not going to be pushed around.
To many people across East Asia, the idea that mask wearing is controversial just seems strange. This is the sound of a documentary aired on Japanese public television. It shows high-speed video of people sneezing and coughing, first while not wearing a mask and then with one on. The dramatic difference in the volume of droplets ejected and the distance those droplets travel is clear for all to see.
I'm probably as baffled as anyone else.
James Whitlow Delano is an American photojournalist and longtime Tokyo resident. Standing in a park near his house, wearing a mask, he told me there is no question where he'd rather be during this pandemic.
I'd rather be here. I think that Japanese, generally speaking, are more civic-minded, community-minded. They care, frankly, more about their neighbors. Individualism is great. It's baked into who I am. But this is a time to set that aside for other people.
Walk around Tokyo and you'll see people wearing masks while walking their dogs, working on construction sites, even while cycling and jogging. That may seem a bit extreme, but until there is a vaccine, people here seem to have accepted this is the new normal. And if it can help to protect themselves and others, it is a discomfort they appear willing to bear.
That report by Rupert Wingfield-Hayes. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
The spill that will occur ranges from the size of Exxon Valdez, which was devastating and cost ultimately more than $7 billion to clean up, to four times that size. And the impact on the marine life of the Red Sea would be catastrophic.
A warning about the potential threat if there's a leak from a huge oil tanker that's moored off the coast of Yemen. Apple has been told that it will not have to pay the Irish government 13 billion euros in back taxes after winning an appeal at the European Union's second highest court. It's a major blow for the EU, which wants to crack down on alleged tax avoidance. I've been speaking to our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker.
This was not just an appeal by Apple, it was also an appeal by Ireland. The tax that the European Commission had alleged was owing was owed to Ireland, but it wasn't paid because, they said, of an agreement between Apple and Ireland, which constituted an illegal state subsidy to the company. Now, what the European Court has decided is that it was not actually an illegal state aid, that it wasn't a special favour done for Apple as such and therefore the tax is simply not owing. But it does mean that Apple is in a situation where it has been paying an extraordinarily low amount of tax on the profits that it does in effect earn in the European Union. And there's quite a bit of controversy in Ireland. I mean, there are some people there who say, thank goodness for this ruling, it means a commitment that the Irish government entered into with a company can stand. But there are others who are saying, you know, that we really could do with the money, especially at a time when the government finances have been severely damaged by the pandemic.
Andrew, this isn't the final decision. There is a more senior court that they can appeal to, presumably.
The European Commission might well appeal to the highest court in the European Union. Yes, that's absolutely right. And the Commission is doing various other things to try and address what it sees as being excessively low amounts of tax paid by businesses across Europe as a result of deals they enter into with individual member states. But I think there's no question that this ruling by the EU's General Court, as it's known, is a major setback for that effort.
I mean, I suppose, as you were saying there, it's a setback, and it may well encourage other countries to come forward bidding for these huge amounts of money, bidding for companies to come and put their taxes and revenues through their countries.
That's right, although bear in mind there is, in the years since this arrangement with Ireland and Apple was in place, there have been quite significant international efforts to agree systems to reduce the scope that multinational businesses have for arranging their affairs so that they don't pay tax. Now, we've got no definitive resolution to those efforts, but they are underway and they do significantly change the environment in which governments will take these kind of decisions.
That was Andrew Walker. A former nursing assistant in the US state of West Virginia has admitted murdering seven patients. Rita Mays killed the elderly men at a hospital for veterans in the city of Clarksburg. Charlotte Gallagher reports.
The family of Felix McDermott thought he died of natural causes until the FBI knocked on their door. The agents wanted permission to exhume Mr. McDermott's body, and a later post-mortem examination showed he'd been killed by an insulin injection. He was one of seven elderly men killed in this way at the hospital between 2017 and 2018. Rita Mays, who's 46, murdered the men while working night shifts. No one saw her as she injected them in their beds. After a two-year investigation, Mays pleaded guilty to seven counts of second-degree murder and the attempted murder of an eighth man. She's expected to receive seven life sentences. Doug Olson is from the FBI.
Everybody deserves proper medical care, but there's an increased expectation that veterans receive good medical care after everything they sacrificed for their country. These veterans and their families put their trust in this nursing assistant, and she betrayed that trust and decided to pick and choose who lived and who died. I can only imagine the pain the families have gone through and the anger they must feel.
There have been a number of well-publicized cases of medical staff who murder patients. They're sometimes dubbed angels of death. In the UK, Harold Shipman murdered at least 215 patients while working as a doctor, making him the most prolific serial killer in modern history. While the German nurse Niels Hogel killed at least 85 of his patients. Criminologists have identified three main motives behind these kinds of murders. Firstly, the offender may believe it's a mercy killing to stop a victim's suffering, or they could be using their position as a way of exerting power and control over their victims. A third category, the malignant hero, is used to describe those who endanger a patient's life, then appear to try to save them for praise and attention.
Charlotte Gallagher reporting. As we record this podcast, the UN Security Council is due to discuss the issues surrounding a neglected oil tanker moored in the Red Sea off the coast of Yemen with more than 1 million barrels of crude oil on board. The ship had served as a floating oil storage and offloading vessel before most of the crew deserted after Houthi rebels took over the area about 5 years ago. Experts are warning of dire consequences if the vessel is not dealt with. The United Nations is preparing a technical team to visit the area. For more, Alan Kasuja spoke to Dr. Ian Ralby in Baltimore, who's the chief executive of the advisory group IR Consilium and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council.
The tanker itself has about 1.14 million barrels of Marib Light crude on board, spread out over a number of different compartments, more than 30 compartments, and it is still attached to a pipeline, the Ras Issa pipeline, that connects the tanker to much farther inland, a oil facility that is still owned by the Safar company, which is often called CPOC. So there's still about 1 million barrels of oil in the pipeline leading to the tanker, because this was an offshore distribution facility for the Yemeni state-owned oil company.
So we know that there's been an ongoing war in Yemen for a while now, but surely this was a matter that should not have been ignored or continued to go on for so long. Why has that been the case?
Well, the Houthis, who control the area, the coastal area where the tanker is currently located, have used this vessel as leverage for negotiations and in some ways used it as a moat to protect themselves. And so it has been essentially an insurance card for the Houthis to this time.
So the Houthis have had access to this oil all this time. Why have they not used it?
They have had access, but technically it still belongs to CPOC, which still maintains a team on board. And that oil company has the rightful title to the oil. In order to be able to sell it to any credible buyer, they would need the permission of the company that technically owns it. And that has to be brokered through the United Nations. They have been very fixated on the financial payout of the oil, which at their estimation was worth $80 million. The problem is, two things. One, the price of oil has dropped. And two, the quality of the oil on board has degraded over the time that it's been spent sitting in the hot sun of the Red Sea. So realistically, we are looking at more like $5 to $30 million at best, if they can actually find a buyer, compared to the $80 million they continue to talk about.
And what would happen if it actually gave way?
The spill that will occur ranges from the size of Exxon Valdez, which was devastating and cost ultimately more than $7 billion to clean up, to four times that size. And the impact on the marine life of the Red Sea would be catastrophic. The marine life in the Red Sea involves not just the fish, but also a coral system that is unique. It is the most impervious to sea temperature rise anywhere on Earth. Additionally, desalination plants along the coast of the Red Sea are vital for maintaining drinking water. There is only a three-day time lag between when desalination plants go and when major cities along the Red Sea coast lose their drinking water altogether. That is a very fragile vulnerability, and the oil spill, no matter what happens with it, would affect the entirety of the desalination infrastructure of the Red Sea. In addition, we would see interruption of marine shipping, and particularly the access to the port of Hodeidah, which is crucial for bringing humanitarian aid to the population of Yemen, which is already on the brink of famine. So this would quickly catalyze the famine that we have been working to avoid for some time. So this is a very, very far-reaching situation in terms of the fallout.
Dr. Ian Ralby, Chief Executive of IR Consilium, speaking to Alan Kasuja. New research suggests the world's population will peak at 9 billion. That's much lower than had been previously predicted because global birth rates are declining more rapidly than expected. Scientists at the University of Washington say nearly every country will have shrinking and ageing populations by 2100, with huge social, political and economic consequences. Our global affairs correspondent, Naomi Grimley, reports.
According to this study, countries such as Spain, Italy, Poland, Japan and Thailand will see their populations halve in size by the turn of the century. Even China could see a 25% drop. Women's education and better access to contraception are thought to be the big drivers. But Africa should buck the trend, with the population there trebling in size by 2100. Nigeria's population could reach 800 million, putting it second only to India as the world's most populous nation. Not only will this affect geopolitics, it will also mean countries have to rethink their immigration, tax and childcare policies. And with the over 80s outnumbering the under 5s by a ratio of 2-1, there will have to be much better provision for old age.
That was Naomi Grimley. To Bangladesh now, where police have arrested the owner of a hospital in the capital, Dhaka, over allegations that his facility had issued fake coronavirus certificates. Officials said the man, Mohammed Shahid, was caught trying to flee to India disguised in a burqa. And it's not the only hospital to be investigated. I got more on this alleged scam from our correspondent in Dhaka, Akbar Hussain.
It was alleged that the hospital collected more than 10,000 samples and tested only 4,000 at different government health facilities, but they issued COVID-19 reports for all the patients. So actually, they never tested 6,000 samples, but they gave certificates to all the patients, either positive or negative. And it was also alleged that these hospital authorities, they prepared fake coronavirus reports at a computer lab next to their hospital building. The hospital was also charging huge amount of money for the treatment from the patients, although it was supposed to be free according to an agreement signed with the government in the late March. And this was the, widespread allegation against this person.
There seems to be a sort of black market in these negative coronavirus tests. So why might there be a black market? What's the point of having a test like that?
People are desperately trying to get tested in the government facilities. And in the meantime, some private hospitals, they are making money. They are charging huge amount of money just to giving assurance that they will test people who are coming to their hospitals. And there are many people in Bangladesh who actually work in some Middle Eastern countries in Europe. And they have got an idea that while they're traveling to Europe and Middle East, they need to have the negative coronavirus certificate. That's why they tend to buy certificates. And this has become a very profitable business in Bangladesh in the last 2 months.
You were saying that there are very low levels of testing across Bangladesh. What, 180,000 cases so far. But I imagine because of the low levels of testing, the real figure is much higher. What are the estimates?
For the last 5 months, we have seen a very pathetic scenario in Dhaka streets or elsewhere in the country. People were desperately trying to get a seat in the hospital, but they were refused in Dhaka, capital Dhaka, or elsewhere in the country. And many hospitals were shut down because the health systems was not ready at all. The government is saying that they are trying at their level best, but in the practical scenario, we cannot see that. People are very scared once they think that it is better to stay at home rather than going to the hospital, because the hospitals are so poorly managed that they will not get proper treatment in the hospital. This is what exactly people believe in Bangladesh.
Akbar Hussain, our correspondent in Bangladesh. As life gradually returns to something approaching normality in France, one of the country's biggest tourist attractions is reopening, the Disneyland theme park in eastern Paris. But there'll be no fraternising with Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck and no grand parade, as strict sanitary rules will be in place. With more details, here's Hugh Schofield.
After the Louvre, the Eiffel Tower and most French museums and other theme parks, this is the last major reopening for the French tourist industry, and in purely money terms, the biggest. With 15 million visitors a year, Disneyland Paris is Europe's leading tourist destination, and the money it generates is put at more than 6% of France's entire tourist income. For the reopening, there are strict rules in place. Masks are compulsory, and bookings have to be made in advance online. Numbers are to be restricted, and though management won't say exactly by how much, they'll certainly be a fraction of the 80,000 a day that used to enter the Magic Kingdom. Selfies with the cartoon stars will have to be taken at a proper distance. Behind the excitement of the reopening, there's a lot of anxiety about what the future holds. With the COVID closure, the park has lost hundreds of millions of euros, and until the foreign tourists start returning in numbers, its financial situation will remain very delicate.
Hugh Schofield. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this edition or any of the topics we've covered in it, do send us an email. The address, as usual, is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.